say four step.
Craig Jacob Ford.
Trish Leonard Ford.
Board.
Dr. Jennifer Leck, board.
Bill Ventrell, board.
Nick Liebke, board.
Frankie Schenekberg, attorney for the board. Rachel Kears, administrative assistant.
All right, welcome everybody.
Is Mr. Liebke on the phone?
Yes, Nick Liebke, board.
You've been hearing you, Mr. Liebke.
First order of business, the board meeting minutes. The May 24th, 2018, the audio recording has been confirmed that it is audible. Anyone have any questions or concerns with the minutes? Anyone would like to make a motion?
Motion to approve the minutes.
Motion, do you have a second? Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Do you need to do a roll call on that one as well? All right, roll call, please.
Michael Mono, aye. Craig Jacob, aye.
Trish Leonard, aye.
Paul Mittman, aye.
Dr. Jennifer Leck, aye.
Bill Ventrell, aye.
Dick Liebke, aye.
All right, thank you. First item on the agenda is the supplemental license application for a change of ownership for Penn Foster College. Get settled if you just introduce yourself.
Hi, good morning. My name is Heather McAllister. I'm the general counsel of Penn Foster, and along with me today is my colleague James Baker, who's the controller of Penn Foster. And just wanted to give a brief opening statement. As you're aware,
is there anyone on the phone for you as well?
I know Connie Dempsey introduced herself.
Rebecca McGovern.
Rebecca McGovern.
All right.
So, as you're aware, the Bain Capital Double Impact Fund acquired Penn Foster from Vistra and Falcon on April 30th, 2018. The Bain Capital Double Impact Fund is a fund with approximately $390 million in capital. The fund acquires mission-driven companies where it can make meaningful change in certain areas such as education. And that was the case for Penn Foster. I'd like the board to know that Penn Foster continues to be directly owned and operated by Penn Foster Education Group and its parent company, Education Holdings One. Further, Penn Foster is continuing and will continue to operate in the ordinary course without interruption under its new owners. And as part of the Penn Foster management team, I'm very excited about this change and the value-added approach that the Bain Double Impact Fund is going to bring to the school. I'd like to now turn this over to James, our controller, to answer or give an overview of any questions or comments on the financials. And then, of course, both of us are available to answer any questions that you may have.
Hi, as Heather said, I'm James Baker, controller for Penn Foster. We have completed the financial disclosure schedules associated with the change of ownership. A lot of numbers, a lot of financial statements, and I'm pleased, along with Heather, to be part of the team that is going to run the company from with the new ownership and available to answer any questions you may have regarding the financial information we've submitted. Thank you.
Anyone have any questions?
I have a question. You, the current balance sheet and then the projections for the next 2 years, there seems to be a decrease in total assets from $70 million, $63 million, $58 million. I was wondering, and there may be the answer somewhere in the 474-page document. It was 474.
Yeah.
So my question is that just ordinary depreciation, or is it any assets, and are any of them in management?
No, you hit the nail on the head. We have a significant amount of depreciation and amortization associated with our intangible assets. That will continue for a period of time. It will diminish slightly, but it's in the neighborhood of $10 to $9 million a year. That drives the net asset values down. We will also see a slight increase because we project revenue increases. We'll see a slight increase in our deferred revenues. But the principal driver and the reduction in the net asset values is the net depreciation amortization.
So I'd like to ask a question because I'm a relatively new board member, and so I haven't been here for all the information that you provided in the past. But what was the purpose of this transaction?
Basically, our previous ownership elected to sell the business to Bain Capital Double Impact Fund. Bain Capital Double Impact Fund. The new owner is interested in our type of business, the education, and their mission is aligned with our mission in terms of providing educational opportunities for students to improve their lives. So it was driven really by the previous owners connecting with the current owners.
Okay. Is there any commitment to invest funds directly into Penn Foster to improve operations or to expand the business?
Our projections are that our revenue will grow, and Bain Capital Double Impact Fund is committed to continuing to invest both in our technologies and other, which are principally where we invest our monies as a distance education company. They're very committed to that, as well as to participating in the overall strategy of our business to ensure that we have financial stability and growth.
If I can continue, in our meeting with you in June, I'm sorry, I don't remember if you were...
Telephone?
Were you with us by telephone?
Yes.
We reviewed your first quarter results, which were better than expected, both in new students and in operating income, better than the forecast that you had provided us.
Correct.
So can you give us any idea of what the second quarter is going to look like in terms of that?
The second quarter will not be as good as the first quarter. Typically, we have some seasonality in our business, but also we have had some extraordinary expenses associated with the sale, which will be reflected in the second quarter. Our cash flows are still positive, and we believe that we're going to be more or less on track, other than those extraordinary expenses.
Okay. So if we take those out, and I'm sure they'll be separately stated.
Right.
So we'll be able to identify those.
That's correct.
We'll be able to see whether or not you're trending in the right direction.
That's correct. Yes, sir.
So as we understand it, there's no impact on the current students, current programs, by this change in ownership. Is that correct?
Correct.
That's correct.
In January, you had you responded to a DAC. I don't remember exactly what the nature of it was. You had responded to the DAC report or awaiting some kind of determination from them.
I believe DAC
had... I don't think anything had come through by the June 28th meeting that we had.
I believe you're referring to DAC's request for some additional forecast information, which was provided to them, and they were satisfied with the information provided.
Any other questions?
I have one more question. Just out of curiosity, now I'm looking at the post-closing ownership structure, right? One of the documents.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I see Penn Foster, Inc., and then there's Penn Foster Education Group, right? And so there's the U.S. Penn Foster, Inc., and then there's the Canadian holdings on the other side. Right? And then above that, there's Education Holdings, which I think was a parent company prior to the Bain acquisition.
And still is.
Then there's, just to satisfy my curiosity, kind of walk us through, like, so above that is TVGIE PPE, and then above that is subsidiaries. Oh, I'm sorry. And then there's, oh, I guess that's just TVG, then the Bain Capital, then ECBI. So I guess that's Bain
that's
Capital
their
again.
Fund. Yep.
So, so TBG is, what is that?
Simply a holding company. Yeah. It all it does is own EH1. It really has no impact on the operation of the business.
And it was there prior to.
Yes, it was.
It's
prior,
a continuing.
It was
entity,
there prior yeah. to the acquisition and
it's
remains
not
there.
A new entity. Yeah.
Okay, I'm just trying to understand yeah. how this works. So Bain, the giant fund,
right.
invests, owns 70% of it, and then they create a holding company, which is PCDI Nexus Holdings, right?
Mm-hmm.
And do they have other, either schools or other companies also? It's just they have a fund, they create a holding company exclusively for this enterprise. Okay. And then the TBG was in existence, Education Holdings was in existence. And then,
that's correct.
That's very good. Yeah. They may recruit you. I mean, they may recruit you. That was a very good analysis. Yeah.
Okay. It's just.
It's just a very it's a long, you know.
Yeah. Ownership change, yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
And since you said that it won't have an impact on the students, for the term system, there are that many chief
layers.
You know, was that going to have a little negative downflow there? But sounds like you're comfortable with it.
Yeah, we're absolutely comfortable with it. And, you know, frankly, again, from the management team perspective, I think it's only going to be value-added and, you know, helpful to kind of the next phase of the school and everything that the students are hoping to get out of it.
Any further discussion?
No.
Someone would like to make a motion?
Madam Chair, I'd like to make a motion that we approve the change of ownership application and maintain the $50,499 security bond and continue quarterly reporting.
Motion, do we have a second?
Second.
All right. Any other comments, discussion? All right, all those in favor by roll call?
Craig Jacob, aye.
Trish Leonard, aye.
Paul Mittman, aye.
Dr. Jenner Fleck, aye.
Bill Van Twill, aye.
Dick Lidke, aye.
All right. I have a motion and second. I will ask the school if they accept maintaining the surety bond and continue on quarterly reporting.
We do.
The surety bond was $50,499. All right. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate your time and support on this, and thank you for your time this morning.
Maybe next time 200 pages.
I'm sorry.
Maybe next time 200 pages.
Yeah, I know. Sorry, we need to cut it back a little
bit. Could you make the temperature less than 100 next time?
115.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks so much.
All right.
The next item on the agenda is the update and regular degree granting license renewal for Arizona Summit Law School. Would you come forward and Ms. Sandhills would like to give us a summary?
At the April meeting, 2017, the board there's a notice of the ABA probation at the review of the board since that time, some has appeared before the board as required on a quarterly basis and prepared an update. At the meeting in April, the board requested, Summit requested the board to revise the amount of charity bond from 1.5 to 1.168 on the June 2017 audit. And the board agreed to that, as well as that the current consent agreement was remaining full for that. On June 8th, Wood, and then some of the notice that the ABA gave it as an attempt to withdraw some of the approval on compliance with several standards that I've listed to you. Some of this is the DOT, the USDA, providing an update to from the builders, the Paul Stanley, the attorney, the president, Peter.
Gopler-rude.
Thank you for saying that.
It's a mouthful.
Ms. Stanfield, we may also have Scott Thompson on the phone.
Yes, I'm on the phone, Nicole. Thank you.
All right. Who wants to be the spokesperson?
Good morning. On last week, I provided an update to the board in terms of the actions that have been taken by Arizona Summit since the notification in June by the ABA. We've been very aggressive in pursuing the appeal, and we filed the appeal documents in a timely manner. We're waiting for the ABA to notify us of the hearing panel as well as the hearing date. We anticipate that to come at any time now. That hearing could be either August or September. Our estimate is that there would be a final decision by the Appeals Council sometime in October of this year. We currently are working with our students with respect to ensuring that they their best interests are taken care of in terms of graduating those students who are graduating both the spring and the summer. We have, I believe in the update, I identified approximately 4 students graduating this summer. That's been updated. There's probably going to be about 16 to 20 students graduating this summer, that might be slightly more. We currently only have approximately 100 students enrolled in the school. By the time summer is over, the anticipated number of students enrolled would be approximately 60 or 61. I know just looking at the registration roster in terms of classes for the fall, we have approximately 61 students. We've been meeting with ASU as a potential teach-out partner in trying to be proactive in planning if there's an adverse decision by the appeals panel of the ABA. And so we've had some very productive meetings with them, and President Gopler-Rude can certainly speak to that. I also provided, I believe, a list of the jurisdictions that our summer students who are graduates who are taking the bar, which occurred yesterday and Tuesday. We had approximately 147 students taking bar exams across the country, approximately 75 of those in Arizona, 23 first-time sitters, 52 repeat sitters. We had a number of students going as well as New Mexico. That's our next highest jurisdiction in terms of students sitting. But we've got approximately 53 students nationwide taking the bar for the first time, approximately 94 nationwide taking the bar as a repeat sitter. We're certainly open for any questions that you might have of us this morning.
In the past, when you've come before us, you've talked about students taking the bar in other states, and that some states aren't so generous in giving you updates. From the February test, were you able to get any information from other states?
We are still in the process of getting all of the information from the jurisdictions. I probably can provide an update report to the board based upon all of the information that we gathered. Some of the states are just a little bit slow in reporting the information, and so it's been trickling in, but I think we've pretty much gotten all of the information, so I can provide that update to you fairly shortly.
Do you have a general sense of how that February test went?
Well, in terms of Arizona, we were right at our predicted bar pass rate, which was about 31.1%. and that we predicted 31%. In the next highest jurisdiction, New Mexico, I believe we came in at about 54%. Don't hold me to those numbers exactly, but that's what I remember. But I can certainly include that as part of the report to you.
Sure, that'd be great. Thank you. Anyone else have questions?
Can you talk us through a little bit about New Mexico?
No, well, the number that I put in the report was based upon just looking at the information from the registrar in terms of who had filed what's known as intent to graduate in the summer. And so at the time that I prepared the report, we only had 4. When I checked yesterday, we had 16. So summer's classes just ended, and actually finals end tomorrow. And so we will have a better count even next week as grades go in. Grades have to be submitted by August 17th, and so that's kind of our drop-dead date in terms of who is graduating this summer. So it actually could be more than 16 once we get students filing those intent to graduate. A lot of times students, they're so busy doing externships, classes, and things in the summer, they forget that little thing, and we sent out a reminder to them to please file your intent to graduate. And so yesterday when I checked, we had about 16 that would be graduating this summer.
Back and forth going on in the arts and field going forward, do you feel it would be different in the situation of providing this? Like they expressed in something that's clear in regards to it's still not, your rationale is still not what you intend for them to move forward. What would be different for this time?
Well, I think that we provided you a copy of the appeal document, and the thrust of the document includes a fairly significant list of failure of the American Bar Association to provide due process in terms of notice and opportunity to cure any deficiencies that they may have deemed to be deficient. You cannot correct something if you don't know what you're correcting. And we have taken such progressive actions in the last 18 months or so in terms of curricular changes, program changes, ensuring that our students have adequate academic support and success. And quite frankly, it's hard to understand what it is that they are looking for because they don't tell you what they're looking for. Most of the hearings of the ABA, it's sort of an inquisition of trying to find fault in everything that we report, as opposed to finding improvement. So, for example, Arizona Summit is the only law school in the country that has raised its entering credentials by 5 points, meaning our 25th, 50th, and 75th percentile LSAT scores have gone up at least 5 points. No other school in the country has raised it that high and so quickly. That was not an issue. I mean, that was not something that they were even concerned about or even asked us really about when we went to the last hearing. So it's really hard to understand what the ABA is looking for when they don't really give you any concrete details of what they want. President Goffelrud, who has much more experience with the accreditation process and the ABA, can speak to his observations. He's been at many of the hearings that we've appeared before.
Just real quick.
Sure.
Maybe I'm looking at this too simply, but we've been meeting like this for 2 years, and I thought the whole gist of the issue with the ABA was your low pass bar pass rates.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think they're telling you what the issue is, and you've done a lot of things to try to remediate
that. Right, and our
where they want, I guess.
And our pass rate it has gone up. So, for example, we operate, and as you know, using a lot of metrics. People who are working specifically looking at our students and predicting what the pass rate has been. Since I've been the interim dean, the pass rate has steadily gone up. And so, for example, last year we told the ABA we believe that our pass rate in for the February exam will be at about 31%. That was about four to five points higher than the last bar exam. But the ABA hasn't said, well, we want you to be at 50% or we want you to be at 60%. They haven't given us that parameters. And so we've actually predicted what our pass rate is going to be, have actually exceeded that prediction, and yet that doesn't seem to please them. We also presented to the ABA that we know, based upon the entering credentials of our students, that all of our students have a 50% predicted first-time pass rate. Everybody's not going to pass the bar the first time around, but people eventually pass the bar, and that's what we've seen with our students. And so we're just not sure, I'm not sure, actually, what it is that the ABA is really looking for.
So at any of this time, with your communication with the ABA and your forecasting these bar rates that you're going to be passing at, they haven't communicated back to you, this isn't good enough, or
no, they have not.
They don't set a bottom first-time pass rate or ultimate pass rate on this?
They do set an ultimate pass rate of 75%, and we've been compliant with the ultimate pass rate for all of our cohorts.
But there's not a first-time.
That's repeaters.
There's no first-time.
If I could jump in on this, there are actually, within the ABA standards, there are two different ways that you can be in compliance with the bar pass. Either first time, there's a set of metrics for first time pass rate, and then there's the ultimate pass rate. And the ABA actually is in the process of changing the requirement to only have an ultimate pass rate. They are recognizing finally that throughout the country, bar pass rates have been going down, and that there are different issues within each state. So they're working their way towards only an ultimate bar pass rate. And as Dean Willrich just noted, Summit has been in compliance with the ultimate bar pass requirement throughout its entire history. The other thing that I would add here is a little bit of color on the process and for the appeal, and how that is different than every step over the last couple of years with the accreditation committee and the council of the section of legal education and admissions to the bar. The appeal is from the council's decision, and that is to a special appeals panel that is made up of five individuals who are not on the council, not on the accreditation committee, and have had nothing to do with any of the proceedings up to this point. From that five-member panel, they will choose three members to be what's called the proceedings panel. And the appeal, you'll note if you read the document that we submitted, the standard of review for that panel is that we have to show that the actions of the council and the accreditation committee were arbitrary and capricious. I, along with three or four other folks, worked on the drafting of that appeal, worked on poring through 2 years of records with the ABA, and I can tell you, and I will obviously I'm not completely objective on this, but it is, it's a record that just reeks of arbitrary and capricious action on their part, and we spent 60-plus pages detailing that in minute detail with specific references to the record, specific comments by members of the council. We also drew the comparison to how regional accrediting bodies deal with institutions that they are accredited. The regional accreditors, almost without exception, work heavily in cooperation with their accredited institutions and do exactly what Dean Willrich indicated has not been done here, and work with them and tell them what's wrong. Here are some ways that you can correct it. Let us work with you. I have done accreditation for the ABA. I've chaired more than half a dozen site teams and participated in more than a dozen site visits over the years. And the process has changed in the last few years in terms of how the accreditation committee has viewed things and the council, and it's a lot less transparent. It's a lot less consistent. There are schools that have been found significantly out of compliance. And just one example within the last month, now back in compliance with bar results and incoming student credentials, not as strong as Summit. So that's part of that. That's the heart of the appeal, is that their action is arbitrary, has been arbitrary and capricious. And I feel that it is a very strongly supported and soundly argued appeal. We'll have a chance, obviously, to further argue it at the point that there's a hearing.
I appreciate you explaining that, because I was wondering, your appeal sounded a little argumentative.
It would be nice to have a very very calm, professional, cordial communication with them on this, but we're at the point where, particularly because of what the standard of review is, we have to take that approach.
And so, what happens if this appeal is denied? Is there another?
No.
Of course, okay.
No.
So you've refunded tuition deposits for your fall class, right?
Correct.
And your admissions team, do you still have them on board, or did you reduce that staff?
That staff has been reduced.
Okay. So those actions seem to me like you are very concerned about this appeal, that it's not going to go through.
Well, I think we're being reasonable and sensible in terms of the management of the school. We are, and that's the reason for having the parallel discussions with Arizona State with regard to a teach out. Our first and foremost concern is the students, and making sure that they have, each and every one of them has a pathway to graduate and take a bar exam wherever they choose to do so. We've had several meetings with them at this point. I also met with the ABA's Executive Director of Accreditation last week to give them a heads up that we're working on this on a parallel basis, and have provided them with detail. There's some possibility we can get at least an agreement in principle, if not fully papered, that would be a contingent sort of agreement within the next week to 10 days.
Can I also go back to the students graduating? Something that I just was curious about. You said that you're adding up the forms for the students who are completing an intent to graduate, but that's like a individual student thing that they can do at any time. Why wouldn't, I'm assuming the students go in a program of study, and you can tell which students have taken all the courses, so why wouldn't you project graduation based on those students that have completed courses versus the ones that turn in the forms?
Well, we can, and that's where the number 4 came from. But based upon students, some students take classes in the summer that will elevate them to graduation status. Some students take online courses. They may visit at another school. So we have to get all of those grades in and then determine who's eligible to graduate. But one of the things that the students have to do prior to that, and that's sort of the trigger for us, is to file the intent to graduate form so that we'll know. And based upon the number of students who filed it as of yesterday, I believe there's about 16 people scheduled to graduate this summer. So
that's interesting. So you don't schedule that? You don't schedule them so they can see when they're going to be done with their classes?
Well, they do, and they have a degree audits, and they meet with their academic advisors and that sort of thing. But from an administrative perspective, from the dean's perspective, I'm not looking at those records. That's my registrar and other folks in there. And so the report that I got initially when I did this report to you was that there were 4 students listed to graduate in the summer. But as I spoke to the registrar yesterday, and she said it looks like we have about 16 that may graduate. There may be more as we finalize grades and that sort of thing.
And to clarify, law students are not summer school is not a mandatory part of the education. And I'm assuming that when you were preparing this, this was prior to the start of summer school, and people jumped in and took some extra courses that got them on a path
to
go ahead and graduate in August instead of December.
Yeah, you're operating to me like a nursing student does. Some go year round and some skip the summer, and that's why I was like, but I can still tell where they are in the path, and that's why I was curious.
Exactly.
I have a couple of other questions. The 30 to 40 that you're estimating likely to transfer in the fall, have these students indicated that whether you continue on as a school or not, they're going to transfer, or are they seeking it only if you don't retain your accreditation?
Well, I think part of the part of what the students that I know that are looking at transferring to another school are doing is that they are wanting to make sure that they have a path in case we don't prevail in the appeal. And so I think that's the number one concern for them, is to have a path to continue their legal education. As you know, historically, many of our students have been recruited by ASU and they've transferred to ASU. We do know that a few of them have been accepted for transfer by ASU. We know that a few of them have been accepted for transfer by other schools across the nation. And so the estimate right now is between 30 and 40. We don't have a concrete number as yet, because until the student withdraws from our institution, we don't know that they've actually transferred. And so so this is just the estimate based upon the number of, for example, we have to send letters of good standings to other law schools when students have made an application to transfer. And so based upon the number of good standing letters and requests that we've made in the process, or sending transcripts to the other law schools, that's just the estimate right now.
And the students have been well advised on more than one occasion of what the timetable is potentially for the appeal, and those who are interested in transferring know that they probably need to go ahead, and if they really are thinking about transferring as either a personal desire apart from this process, or as a safeguard to ensure a known path for them at this point in time, with fall semesters starting at every school in the country sometime between the middle of August and early September, and the possibility of no end result for the appeal process until a month after that. I suspect that most of those folks that we're estimating right now to be transfers will indeed transfer.
At one point, you were, if I remember correctly, you were seeking merging with a school or being sold to another school. Any of those in the works right now?
I don't believe that we're pursuing that right now in light of the ABA actions. We had developed a very good relationship with a couple of schools, but those plans are just on hold for right now.
If there was contingent on you having the accreditation?
Yes.
Are some of the students who are closer to graduation, are they increasing their workload to be able to graduate earlier?
Actually, we're trying to look at and make any curricular changes that we can that will reduce their workload, so it wouldn't be an undue burden. So, for example, we had increased our number of experiential credits that students needed to graduate to 6, and we reduced that to 3, so that students can either do an externship or do pro bono work to get the experiential live client work. So we reduced that. We also had required some courses that probably should, they don't have to be required courses, and many law schools across the country don't require them. So we made those courses elective courses as opposed to required courses, and that way students could fulfill graduation requirements without the necessity of those courses.
If I remember correctly, you'd made some courses required because they were areas that people were not doing well at the bar, so have you now reversed that so they'll graduate but they won't pass?
Well, there's a couple of courses that really are not, that we made required courses that really probably don't have to be required courses. One was a course that's called UCC Sales. Another one was Secure Transactions. But in for the most part, all of the required courses that we believe are important for students to take to pass the bar are still the required courses. So all of the fundamental base courses plus several of the upper level elective courses are still required. And so these were courses that we didn't feel that necessarily they needed to be required for the students to pass the bar.
So did you essentially do a program version change then, because you're reducing the total number of credits that the students are required in order to graduate? Is that what I'm understanding?
I'm sorry?
Did you do essentially like a program version change? You used to have a program requiring so many credits, and now you have a program requiring less credits?
Yes.
Right, and that went through here? Private post-secondary, you submitted that as a program note?
It wasn't necessarily a program change to the extent that we needed approval of the board. It was just looking at certain courses and then having the faculty vote on whether or not those courses needed to be maintained as required courses. So it was like a curricular change as opposed to a program change. It's not a program change, it's just a curricular change.
So the students are graduating with the number of credits in the program that you've submitted to Arizona Private Post-Secondary?
I believe
not less than.
I don't know what you're referring to. So I don't know what document you're referring to, so I can't really answer your question.
Okay, well, when you submit a program, am I crazy? When you submit a program...
are you talking about in 2005 when we submitted a program?
No,
like
submit them all the time.
To get a master's degree, you need 120 credits.
Right.
How many credits do you need to get your degree?
83 credits.
Did you change that number, or did you just change the mix of what makes up the 83?
Are they graduating with 83 credits now, or less than?
Yes, they're graduating with 83 credits now.
So some of the students maybe had electives, had other courses.
Yes.
But they wouldn't have to take these particular courses, but now they don't have to take those, so they're good with the number of credits they have.
Yes, and they still have the 83 credits.
Oh,
God. I do have a couple extra. In that line, just a curiosity, because, I mean, we're seeing new faces this time, I believe. And you said you reduced the admission staff. How many staff are left supporting these students?
So we have five faculty members, and we have approximately seven administrative staff personnel in the various departments.
So five faculty members are teaching 100 students over how many courses? Like, are they? Is like we have super small class sizes of a couple?
Very small class sizes. This summer, I would say we have larger classes because the students are taking courses that they want. Particularly, it's a required course, and so you would have a class between 10 to 30. I would say no class over 30 students.
And then just I wanted to clarify. You said that this last February you anticipated a first-time pass rate of 31%, and you did 31.1, correct?
Yes.
What was last year's February pass rate, year over year?
Oh, I don't recall, but it's about 25 or something like that, maybe. Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, because I know Ms. Wilrich, I think you joined the school at some point during our...
Well, I've been with the school since 2005 as a professor, but okay. I became the interim dean in January of 2017.
I was just wondering how you guys are holding up.
you know?
Yeah, I mean, in all honesty, and sort of yeah. What's the climate of the...
Yeah, well, of course...
One way or the other...
Very sad.
Whatever you have to do moving forward is not kind of like yeah. Just yeah. Continue or close the door.
Yeah, well, it's I would say the staff that's left, they are very hardworking, dedicated people, just a joy to work with. But I would say the tenor, of course, is very sad. I've been with the school for 14 years. That's blood, sweat, and tears in building an institution, a really fine institution, working, I believe, with some of the best legal colleagues in the country. Teaching a cadre of students and offering an opportunity to students, who some of whom would never have gotten into law school. And when I look at what many of our students are doing in the legal community across the country, just wonderful contributions that they're making to the legal community and to our community in general. If you ever have a chance to pick up a copy of the Maricopa County Attorney, every month you will probably find between 3 to 5, maybe more, Arizona Summit students who have been tapped as the Attorney of the Month because of their commitment to helping the poor and the unserved. Sorry, this is a very sad situation for me. So of course the situation is sad. I mean, it's I would have never expected the ABA to take the action that they have done. Their action, in my opinion, is senseless, and it is without consideration in terms of the added value that Arizona Summit has brought not only to this legal community in general, but into the national legal community. Does not give any credit to the diversity that we have brought to the legal profession and to the mission of giving an opportunity to folks who would necessarily be shut out of a career as a professional in law. And because of that, it, of course, everyone at the school is very sad, and it's going to be a very sore loss to the community if the ABA pulls our accreditation. Sorry. I'm a crybaby at
times. Can I ask a follow-up question to that,
sure.
Though? Because of the position you're in, I think people tend to get, even the staff and faculty tend to get nervous about what their futures also entail. How are you going to retain these remaining 12 people through this process?
Well, I can tell you that every person that I talk to, and I have a very close relationship with everybody on our staff, but everyone I've talked to, the thing that they tell me is that, Dean, I'm committed until the end. And if there's no end, I'm committed forever. And that's how the people feel. We've certainly had to make some very tough decisions in the last year. We have done reduction in forces, and that I'm telling you, that was the toughest decision that I've certainly participated in my life, because these are all dedicated professionals who have made a valuable contribution to the life of the school and the lives of the students. And right now, everyone on board is concerned about the well-being of the students, and we're concerned about, if we have to close the doors at Arizona Summit, to do it with dignity and integrity, because that's what we've brought to the community.
If I may ask just one other curiosity question. You've been interim dean now for a year and a half.
Yes.
I'm curious as to why still interim.
Well, we had a hiring process, and that hiring process went forth, and my name was among those. But as we were participating in the process with the ABA, one of the things that I recommended to the then-president Lively, I said, you know, I think that we need to just put our dean process on hold for now and really concentrate on identifying what is it that the ABA is really looking for, because it seemed like the more we did, and we developed, our faculty developed a very concise and specific, reliable plan that the ABA didn't even acknowledge, even though we submitted it over a year ago. It took them a year to tell us, we don't like your reliable plan. And it's like, well, why couldn't you have told us 30 days after we submitted it so we could have made any necessary changes? But so we decided to just put the dean search on hold in order to address those issues with the ABA. And I think that was the best decision.
One last question. With the number of students who are enrolled in the for the fall, registered for the fall?
Yes.
So there are currently 102 active, and then minus those who will graduate this summer, but 61 have enrolled for the fall. So the students who are trying to transfer, do you think those are the ones who haven't registered?
Yes. Yes. And I know that based upon our summer graduation, when we get those results, the 61 number will probably reduce a little bit because some of those folks who may graduate this summer are among the 61 who may have registered, because our registration for the fall actually occurred in June. And so they generally register and then we'll just take them out of the course if they've already graduated.
Can I just make a comment?
Sure.
Just, you know, we've seen at least two of you multiple times, and as stressful as this is, it's probably not in the top 10 of what you've been dealing with. So I just want to acknowledge that, you know, this is obviously, you know, an issue with a long history, and the work that you've done, you know, I just want to acknowledge that. Probably not.
And that was in line with why I asked if you were still interim. I would just say you might want to consider after what she's done. I mean, honestly, it's this is hard. I've seen this. I've lived through something. But you've done an amazing job as far as, I've never seen someone so dedicated. You're in here. You're there every time. I wish the results were different. But just kudos.
Well, I thank you. I mean, it's been a pleasure to come to the board, and you know, my goal, as I said when I first appeared in 2017, was to be responsive to the board, to be as transparent, provide information in a timely way. One of the things that the board expressed to me during my first hearing was that that you'd like to see the number of complaints from Arizona Summit reduce, and I knock on wood and, you know, prayers and candles lit, I think we've managed to kind of curtail that. And we did that simply by my just asking the academic dean, our director of students, and other administrators, just follow our policy. Just follow our policy and be consistent. And with that, those kind of directions, I think you've seen a positive result in not having those student complaints. And so, you know, we hope that that continues to go forth. I can tell you that you have some students who are very proactive, and they're taking charge of their lives, and they're saying, okay, I'm in this situation, I've got to figure out what I'm going to do. And some students are figuring it out. We've got a few students who are just sort of waiting around for us to do something. It's like, you know, every day students come and I'm saying, okay, are you talking to me as your mom, or are you talking to me as your academic advisor? Because a lot of times I think they just want me to say, well, this is what you should do, and that sort of thing. And I'm trying to get them to be proactive and think about their career and the career choices, and to make good choices. But some of them, you know, they're scared. And I, you know, I really feel for them because, you know, I was a law student once and I just never been in their position, but I could just imagine how they feel, particularly for those who are so close to graduation. But we're doing the best that we can.
Well, best of luck.
And we do commend you and, you know, you two ladies have been here a lot. I feel like we know you well by now. and all of the staff who have, in fact, you stayed and you for coming on board. So I'm sure that was very brave of you to do also. So thank you for all of that. And hopefully the next time we see you, it will be with more positive news. So before we make a motion, can I ask Ms. Stanfield, what would be the next step for them at either side of the results that they get back? When would you want to see them again?
October, middle of October would be the likely time for the appeal decision to be rendered.
Okay. So we'll welcome you back in the October.
Okay.
Good. Thank any you. Further discussion?
Motion? I move to approve Arizona Summit Law School license renewal with the stipulation that the consent agreement and the jury bond remain in full force.
Motion second?
Second.
Great. Motion second. Do you accept that stipulation? Yes?
Currently, the consenting requires the bond submission of student law with quarterly updates with the board. Did you want a student to talk to them?
As a required one, or if they get one that they provide it?
The ABA directive to submit a teach-out plan is stayed when you submit an appeal. We are, as I mentioned, though, doing a teach-out plan as a contingency, and that has not yet been submitted because we haven't reached a final agreement with ASU. That's in the works, but nothing has been submitted, and nothing at this point is required to be submitted either.
I guess I'm knowing how hard it is to get these consent agreements, and there are, you know, only two schools in Arizona they can get one with, and they're working with one. So I fear that if we require them to have one and they can't meet our rule, it will slow them down for, I'd rather not add an extra burden. I think the ABA has got it under control. But,
okay.
I don't know if it's that. All right, so do you accept the original
yes.
consent agreement and the bond?
All yes.
Those. All right, all those in favor by roll call?
Craig Keegan, aye.
Chris Leonard, aye.
Paul Benson, aye.
Dr. Jennifer Leck, aye.
Bill Vance Wool, aye.
Dick Lipke, aye.
All right, congratulations, good luck, and any correspondence that you're getting with the ABA accrediting Department of Ed, be sure that it's given to Ms. Stanfield promptly.
Absolutely,
absolutely.
All right, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
The next item on the agenda is the conditional to regular vocational license renewal for Dev Mountain. Anyone representing the school come forward? And Ms. Stanfield, if you can give us a summary.
Hello, will you state your name for the record, please?
Yes, my name is Daniel Lovell. I am campus director for Dove Mountain in Arizona.
Well, I'd like to make an opening statement regarding how your operations have been going.
Yes, we feel like they are going well. I should also mention that Kristen Hansen and perhaps Brett Schaefer are on the phone. I'm not sure if he made it on the phone or not, but
if you're on the phone, can you identify yourselves, please?
Hi, this is Kristen Hansen from Capella Education Company.
It looks like Kristen's the one that's on the phone. Things have been going well. We started out with running one cohort at a time, one session at a time. We have expanded into doing two sessions at a time. We've been able to maintain good enrollments. They're pretty steady. The students are out getting jobs as they graduate. We're very happy with that. But these things seem to be going great.
Okay, thank you for that. The report says you have 49 students. The enrollment data sheets I have were blank. Can you talk to me about when these students were enrolled and what your progression was as far as enrollments and what you're forecasting for this next coming quarter and possibly the year, please?
Yeah. So we didn't actually start enrolling students until August. So that's why everything seems to be blank. I'm under the impression that nothing was required after July to report. Let me pull up exact.
During the specific period that we asked for our reporting period, we didn't have it all. Subsequently, I spoke with Ms. She gave me this.
Okay. So just add some color to that, please, about the 49 students and what you're forecasting.
Yeah. So currently, right now, we have. We've had a total, if you include up to the most recent enrollments, we actually have 77 based on the numbers I have. And we are currently enrolling every 7 weeks between 10 and 12 students.
Very good. And your relationship with Capella, how is that going?
Great. They are extremely helpful, very supportive. Kristen is on the phone. I have regular conversations with Kristen, making sure that we are doing everything we can to maintain our compliance and do everything you've asked us to do.
Forecast on profitability, you had a slight loss based on this report.
Yes, we had a slight loss. A lot of that just has to do with the fact that we are, you know, just starting out, and there were some initial startup costs that don't necessarily continue on. We decided to hire a little higher talented staff than we initially had planned on, which costs a little bit more money. In addition to that, we flew teachers down from our headquarters in Utah on probably four different occasions. That, you know, some extra travel expenses involved with that in order to provide continuity, to do some training and support of the new school.
And you have adequate staffing?
Yes.
Faculty and administration to handle the student loan where you're projecting to go?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah, and we have a plan going forward as when we hit certain enrollment numbers, we will add staff accordingly. Yes.
That's all the questions I have.
Now, let's have any questions? All right.
Very, very quick one. I'm glad it's going well. Make a motion to approve the conditional to regular vocational program license renewal for Deb Mountain with the stipulation to maintain the 101 surety bond, $101,000 surety.
Thank you. All right. We have a motion and a second. Any other questions? And do you agree to those stipulations to maintain the bond?
Yes.
All right. All those in favor, by roll.
Michael Romano, aye.
Craig Jacob, aye.
Trish Slattery, aye.
Paul Whitman, aye.
Dr. Jennifer Leck, aye.
Bill Venswell, aye.
Dick Lubke, aye.
Congratulations.
I just want to say thank you very much. I'm honored to be a part of Dev Mountain and being a part of the Arizona teaching community.
Great.
Thank you, sir.
Sorry, Daniel. I thought you were going to get pounded, but I guess not.
Be disappointed?
I appreciate it.
And since it obviously works telling people that we don't want to see them for the complaint committee, I'm just going to go ahead and say that to every school
there
now.
It is.
We don't want to see you in front of the complaint committee. Just saying.
I do not plan on... I mean, obviously, I would appear if I was going to leave, but I don't plan on appearing. We have a really good relationship with
them. We're
very open. And
I think it helps you. EA expressly says they need to have good personal hygiene. I think that's a good place to start to not
yes.
have complaints.
Yeah. Occasionally
we run into that. By the way, have you, I remember that, but I'm very curious about your admittance as far as no age limit? Have you got some young people? Or was in the education level? Was?
Yeah, education level, we don't have any education level requirements. We actually yeah. have a really low bar of entry. We try and be accessible. That's a part of who we are. We don't want to be the Harvard of boot camps. We want to be able to give people opportunities. We believe anybody with the right amount of motivation and effort and learn how to do this and change their lives.
Good.
Very nice.
Good to hear.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. The next order of business is the conditional to regular vocational license renewal for Liberty Crane School. If anyone in the audience is for them, come on up. And Ms. Stanfield, if you give us a brief recap.
Program license for training with certain bodies that are required to be known.
Good morning. My name is Darla Kaplan. I'm the office manager for Liberty Crane and Rigging Consultants for Liberty Cranesville.
Would you like sharing the information with the board?
Well, I do have an opening statement from the owner of the company who unfortunately couldn't be here due to prior obligations. He is actually training for the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers in Portland, Oregon. And he was apologized for not being here. To the chairman and board members, thank you for reviewing our application for renewal. Having our application renewed is very important to us. We feel we will be able to provide a much-needed service in our community and the country. Having the ability to provide vocational assistance to people like veterans, adults looking to improve themselves, and young adults with no idea what they want to do in life, to be able to provide them a path to a career freedom is really exciting. Our school advertising tagline is training for career freedom. And I feel that that's really important. During our first year of license, we have not offered any vocational training. So we are not operating currently as the Crane School. We do have Liberty Crane and Rigging Consultants as our primary business. And we've been, because of OSHA regulations, and their deadlines for certifications for crane operators, our classes have been considerable during the last few months. We've also had some staff changes, which has kind of impacted and delayed our starting the school. Our hopes is to actually start it in January. And many of the classes that we currently teach are for mobile crane operators, riggers, and signal people. We do certification as well as qualification, but it's basically for Maricopa County, City of Phoenix, for a variety of businesses, not only in Arizona, but out of state. And that has been the basis of our business for the last 8 years. Opening the Crane School has been a dream for the owner of the company, who's a veteran, and wanting to be able to give that opportunity to others. And that's kind of where our focus is. We want to make sure that the materials that we have that we're currently using are up to par and acceptable for us to actually operate the school. We don't, it's because there's so many safety issues involved, we want to make sure that we don't just jump in head first and have issues down the line. And I welcome any questions you might have.
Currently, you provide training outside of this educational school that you put together.
That is correct. From the very beginning, we have been authorized by the NCCCO, which is the National Commission for the Certification of Crane Operators. They also certify riggers and signalmen. And we do qualification training for a variety of, rigging and signaling and things like that as well. But it's for a variety of businesses.
You mentioned that you haven't been able to see what happened yet. There have been some changes in staffing.
Correct.
And I think demand on the other side of the business.
That is correct. Part of it was last year when we did the original licensing process. I had a salesman that worked for the company who is no longer with us. He left abruptly, so I had to take over his position and kind of learn all the materials and so forth. And we actually had to hire new staff. Well, we're in the process of hiring more staff, actually. We want some more instructors and get them up to program standards and so forth before we start. There was an understanding, I guess, in the beginning that we might be able to work with Gateway College, and that's something we're going to have to revisit. We wanted to be able to accept the GI Bill as well as workforce, and my understanding is we wouldn't be able to do that until we had the license for a year. And I don't know if there's maybe a communication error or miscommunication on our part. I'm not sure. But that was one of the delays in getting going.
The salesperson you're referring to is for school enrollment?
No, he was actually a salesperson for Liberty Crane and Rigging Consultants. He was helping us getting the process for the licensing ready, and he was eventually going to help us with the school as well. He had extensive experience in the crane and rigging field, but for financial reasons, he decided to leave the company abruptly.
Do you currently have any enrollments?
Not for the school, no. Not currently for the school.
A couple things I'm going to go through the question related. Some are just from the consumer aspect of it. What that could look like. So
okay.
Bounce it up. Got some reference why we're asking these questions. Okay. Obviously, one of our biggest concerns is around how consumers will experience it, and then the complaints that may come from the materials that have been provided. But in addition to that, there's a couple other things. It doesn't look like it's posted in type of start dates for classes and like that. I didn't see anything like that.
Not at the moment. That is something that we are working on, and when the owner comes back from his trip in Oregon, we will be addressing some of those things.
No effective teach date.
I think it was a generalization of sometime in January.
And then some of the other elements, specifically around the enrollment agreement, there's some places where, in particular on page 3 of item 5, we talk about the distance or unsatisfactory project. don't really reference on that. So I'm just wondering how to interpret that if I were a student.
And then it's an item 5.
I'm assuming they would explain satisfactory academic level. How?
They do.
Okay. We don't require parties.
That's right.
Okay.
I appreciate that. It seems I'm clear to the faculty students. I'm going to come to the panel. Whereas, in my opinion, as we go along, based on.
Oh, no, there would be specific guidelines set forth. It's not, I believe it is in the catalog, but it's, there definitely would be.
You have some descriptive attendance and then academic as well, and you know, patient in addition to that.
I would probably have to review it again. I don't know the specifics on that one. I apologize.
There are a few areas that just speak to everything kind of funneling through. For kind of determination on the field. One area where it does talk about a delegate, but everything else seems to follow. How do you, with his travel, how do you see that decisions affected?
We are, as I was saying, looking to hire more staff, and we do have a potential trainer as well as someone with the actual business degree and so forth that's probably going to be put in that position to where he could be a sub in case the owner wasn't available. We do anticipate that the scheduling and so forth will change come the time the school gets ready to open.
Maybe something you want to consider just in regards to the language that you have where it's really specified is the owner making.
Correct. We'll certainly look at that.
In page 12 of the catalog, you talk about 30 days no attendance, and that essentially the minimum in school. I'm just trying to appreciate that from the standpoint of the other areas you talk about 85% threshold, page 12. I'm just trying to appreciate this swing, given the short duration of the course, some of the 30 days without posting it, that would ultimately cause removal from the milk that we expected to be final.
I apologize. Those are some of the questions that I didn't quite anticipate. This is not my normal position. I believe that at that point, if that was in regards to the leave of absence.
No, it's not in regards to the leave of absence. It was just stated from an attendance standpoint.
That might be a page 13.
It's the top of page 13.
Yeah.
Top of page 13.
Yeah, and overall 85% attendance. And I apologize, can you repeat the question?
Yeah, so in the catalog it talked about after 30 days a student would be withdrawn from it.
He's saying that's a very generous for short-term program. To say that they can disappear for 30 days and you're okay with letting him resume, we're not telling you you have to change it. It's just not common, so he's just
trying to understand is when it, these are the things that'll end up, you'll end up terminating the student. They'll say, wait a second, I mean, it's 29 days and we're out of town. And we have other places where it's like 85%, so it's a little inconsistent for the community. So that's why I'd ask you to
We will have to review it. I unfortunately was not part of the writing on this, so I'm not sure where they got that information. I think it was a collaboration between a few people, so I will double check on that.
You may be, and these may be out of the scope as well.
Okay.
You talk about postponement and start dates as well, and then you just reference the fact that you followed their normal refund policy on that piece of it, and I'm just trying to understand what your intent as a school to do if you ended up canceling the start date, and the student wasn't part of that, would you provide a full refund to that student, or would you still retain the $50? If you made the decision to postpone or move a start date, it would require a new enrollment agreement. The student chose not to, they would be entitled to a refund, but it would be according to your refund policy, it would be withholding $50. So I'm just trying to appreciate from the student if that would be a full refund or not, and that might be something you'd want to take a look at as well.
Okay. I thought I had read that they were doing a full refund minus the $50.
That is correct. And so I'm trying from a consumer standpoint to say the school has made a decision to cancel the start date or move the start date. I enrolled into it. It no longer fits my time frame. I do not want to attend the school anymore. You're still going to keep my $50 for a decision you made.
We can reevaluate that. Okay.
Actually, if you are canceling the enrollment, you can't then charge the student the $50.
That makes sense. No, that. Correct. That makes sense. Okay.
Can I ask him, Sarah, is this also the school that had that during the program they discontinued their applying the refund policy? Was that this application?
I believe it was.
Okay. So that seemed inappropriate along the same lines, that if you're canceling, the student has already started and they're not withdrawing, you have something happen that you're canceling the right. class. I believe I read that you would still charge them based on the regular refund policy, and I was curious as well, if you're canceling class, why?
I believe that we would do a full refund if it's up to us that we are postponing.
Why don't you do a search in your catalog and to find where it is you're having that statement in one same vein with the $50 also.
We'll have to
review that part. And I understand you do have the standalone modules, so if they have successfully completed the other modules, that's understandable. It's not getting 100% refund if they've successfully completed certain portions.
Correct.
But if you're in the middle of a module and you're discontinuing the class, that would not be appropriate to then charge them.
Right. I think the likelihood that we would do it that way in the middle of a module probably wouldn't happen.
But you need to have the words say it.
Correct.
So we don't have a problem.
Yeah, we're not questioning you're making the right decision of how it can
go. Absolutely.
In regards to essentially your hours, course hours, in alignment with the breaks and class schedules, as it did in the past,
there again, I didn't work.
Yeah. So you call out for a two-day program, you'll have 16 hours worth of instruction, but your breaks and your time within that are only 7 hours per day, so there's disconnect in regards to that of what you're claiming to be essentially those credit hours or hours of operation and that, which will make you involved.
Okay.
What, I'm sorry, what was that?
So if you look at, let's look back a little bit, so if you look at the catalog in regards to the MUD, it calls out the hours associated with each one of the Then you look at their class schedule, page 15. They call out their hours of operation between 8 a.m. and 4:30, and then they have 2:15 breaks an hour long.
It would probably change from 8 to 5.
Yeah, we need to have a look at that.
So like, if you my page 5 straight through to like 10, it kind of gives a breakdown by module and then references at page 15 where they're kind of giving the schedule.
Okay.
And the typical standard is 50 minutes in a 60-minute period counts as an hour. So like the building just being open doesn't count. You have to actually be offering that instruction. And so it could be someone just did the math and said, oh, it's 8 hours a day. But if you're not offering the hours that you're saying that you're offering, then that's a problem. So either your program is less hours or you need to expand your schedule for it to be longer than what you're saying. It is.
Right, because the current schedule, I mean, for the classes that we do currently, a lot of times they do only run like 8 to 4, depending on, or even 7 to 4 sometimes.
That's fine if you want to do that, but if you're saying it's X number of hours, you actually have to offer it that number of hours.
That's where the consumer can come back and say, maybe it was too much training, this many hours, and live up to your
expectations. Okay.
I think in a couple of places you're very specifically saying that you the student will be terminated. You might want to look for that to see if it's more a matter that they may be terminated. Like if they're at the 85% attendance and they go to 84%, are they immediately terminated or are you going to give enough to make up the hours? So just look for the couple of places where you are saying it, because you're absolutely saying you will terminate. You actually can't have an exception unless you have an appeal process. And if you let one person stay and don't let the next person stay, they'll be in here complaining. So it usually behooves you, if it's not a, like a drop-dead thing of where you would have to get rid of them, like it's a safety issue or something, that's understandable that you say that you would terminate someone. But if it's like we require 85% attendance, at the first point they hit less than 85, you're kicking them out, or you're going to offer the makeup hours, you're going to let them stay an extra couple of days, whatever. So only say you will terminate them if you're absolutely positively going to terminate 100% of the time. Otherwise you say may, then you make sure you have internal procedures of what you would do. And referencing how they go about doing makeup hours. Some schools charge extra if they're going to do makeup hours. Others don't. But it behooves you to reference how they would go about if it's gotten behind. You know, they had the flu and they were out for 2 days. Can they ever recover from that, or do they have to give up and quit?
I just have two questions, one comment. On page 14, under your student records policy, it says official transcripts will be provided to the student at no charge. Additional copies are available for $5 per page. I think you probably want to readdress that sentence, because if official transcripts are provided at no charge, I'm not sure where the additional pages would be $5. So it's like, are you saying you're going to provide them one copy on graduation or whatever, but right now it's just, I don't, you say you provide them at no charge, so.
Okay.
And then the only other thing I was curious about is, how are you anticipating students to pay the tuition of $22,000? Is it, you have, like, programs, financing? How
that was
that?
One of the things that we were looking to get into was we wanted to be able to accept the GI Bill.
So that would only be people that qualify for that. So
correct.
What about people who don't
but
qualify?
We also were looking at workforce as well as other financial aid options. And we were told that, like I said, that there was an understanding that we wouldn't be able to accept it until we'd had the license for a year. And so that kind of impacted a lot of the students that we were expecting to bring in. As far as the other options for financial aid, I'm not as familiar with the other programs. We are in the process of trying to find out some more information on that and being able to provide that information on our website to where students can access that information.
Okay. My second... Oh, no, that's it. That was my two questions.
There are some limitations on the GI Bill and the program. We'll get into that.
Right.
If that's your, if you have 100%.
That is not our main focus, no.
No further questions? Would you like to entertain a motion?
Sure.
applications. Additional to regular vocational program stipulations and without maturity bond. Notify the state when the first class is completed. Records. That would also include catalog corrections of the hours to reflect the refund catalog. Based on cancellation by the school.
Okay. Okay, motion, do we have a second?
Second.
Motion, second. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Mike Romano, aye.
Craig Jacob, aye.
Rich Leonard, aye.
Paul Mitten, aye.
Dr. Jennifer Mike, aye.
Bill Ventwell, aye.
And I forgot to ask if you agree to those stipulations. And they will hold your license. Oh, Ms. Lucy, sorry. Ms. Lucy, are you still with us?
Yes. Dick Lucy, aye.
Sorry about that.
Okay.
They will hold your license until you submit those changes.
Who am I submitting those to?
Ms. Sample. Mm-hmm. And if they... aren't adequate, she will let you know, but the license will be held until she sees the changes have been made.
Okay. I appreciate very much allowing me to come today, and hopefully next time, the Honorable Evans.
All right. The next item on the agenda is a regular degree-granting license application for the American Intercontinental University. Do you want to see a report come forward? And Ms. Stanfield is for the school system.
Members of the board, American Intercontinental University is a license. The team that obtained CDC Corporation was approved to operate a administrative center to the International University of Colorado Tech. The IC is now seeking approval to expand and to confer the degrees here. Initially, they intend to offer the programs online. They may begin offering classes at the level on demand. We want to thank Jenna. He suffered with us through, she was the first one to go through the portal. Still suffering through the portal. The application itself is somewhat different. That is one of our enhancements to try and get it forward so it can be that.
Thank you for being a guinea pig.
And Kevin was a great help. Appreciate it.
And Mr. Lucy is your lead.
All right, good morning.
Good morning.
On my notes, I'm not quite sure who's representing the school this morning. I have Jill DeAtley. Is there either Jill has a very deep voice, or there's a gentleman that I'm not hearing?
Good morning. I'll introduce myself. My name is John Klein. I'm the president of American Intercontinental University, and Jill is also here.
All right, very good. Thank you, John. So it's a pretty good application. I like strong financial statements. So I do have a few questions on AIU and some of the litigation that's going on with the various states. In your application, you took great lengths to say that you really can't project what the outcomes of some of these outstanding complaints are. Some of them have been going on for quite some time, actually years, and I was wondering why it's still dragging on, and if you can give the board maybe just a little better insight as to the nature of those complaints.
Mr. Lupke, this is Jill D'Atley. I'll address, there's two different areas. We're publicly traded companies, so we did provide information as disclosed in our public filings with the SEC. The only outstanding major litigation that we have is a case that's with one of our culinary schools, which is now closed in Portland. We have entered into agreements, and we are in the process of settling that. So that one is essentially closed. We've reached resolution with the plaintiffs. We also will be hearing some arbitration cases associated with that, but that is, we consider that one nearly complete from a litigation perspective. The others are related to some of the investigations that we have been subject to, specifically through a multi-state attorney general. We aren't the only organization that's part of that, that have been involved with that. And so we are continuing to work through with them. It is a long process. You can imagine you have 23 states seeking to all reach consensus and also working with our company officials to do that. But that is something that is ongoing, taking the time to be thoughtful about that and having those continuing conversations.
Okay, very good. As far as the FTC, I understand the parent company, which is TEC. Were any of the issues with the FTC related to AIU's operation?
Well, we submitted a document request for all of the institutions at Career Ed. We're unsure if there are any issues. They're still evaluating the requests that they asked us for. So it was a blanket request with a trade commission, and as of this point, we haven't heard of any issues.
Okay. All right, very good. In May of this year, you were scheduled for an HLC evaluation. Did that take place? And if so, can you give us a little summary of the results of that?
Yes, and I do have to preface my statements. We're in a quiet period right now. We actually have a earnings conference call on August 1st, so I'll provide as much color as I can without disclosing non-public information. I can talk in terms of the draft report and so on, but the visit went very well. We reviewed the draft report, and we're actually on the HLC IAC agenda for Monday and Tuesday of the subsequent week here on the 30th and 31st. We anticipate that the IAC will adopt the team's report. And again, without going into too much detail, it was a very positive report.
All right.
Anticipate the IAC adopting it.
All right, very good. And I trust that Dr. Mittman's not running out to buy stock at this point. All right, very good. As far as the heightened cash monitoring, is that still in place at the present time?
It is still in place. Maybe Jill, you can...
The genesis of that action, which dates back to December of 2011, so a number of years ago, were related to some concerns related to our career schools, our Sanford Browns in particular. We've been here before with our Le Cordon Bleu. Scottsdale was pulled into that. AIU was not directly part of that, but because it was a company-wide action that the Department of Education elected to take, it put all of the company's schools on heightened cash monitoring one. In 2011. So it's ongoing. We continue to provide information to them on a monthly basis as required. We do that very smoothly. We've not had major concerns. And so we continue to work with the department through that process.
Okay, very good. In your executive summary to the board accompanying your application, you mentioned that there's a possibility that some of the programs that you currently offer online, you actually might consider offering them on ground in Chandler, Arizona. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Primarily, it would be at the graduate level and probably even more focused with Masters of Education. A number of staff here in Arizona have been here for some time, and we have some long-standing relationships with the school districts in the state, and so there might be an opportunity for us to offer some small cohorts of Masters of Education program. I would anticipate anywhere between 30 to 45 students in a classroom-based environment.
Okay. Terry, will that require a site visit?
Yep.
Okay, very good. And lastly, the retention rates are rather, there's, I guess they're just surprisingly low compared maybe to on ground, and I don't know if I would be safe to say they seem low even for an online program. Can you give us a little color commentary on why that might be?
Sure, and I'll also, I think it plays very well into what I wanted to do with an opening statement and describe what the strategy is around this application. But as many educators would understand, you know, the journey for an online student or online learner is sometimes lonelier than if you're engaged in a campus environment. We have made great strides in improving our retention over the short term by the implementation of what we would call graduation teams, which is a very common terminology in the Valley here, whether it was at University of Phoenix or at Grand Canyon or now at AIU. And so our strategy with this application is to take our graduation teams here in Arizona to the next level and be able to have faculty, both in full-time and adjunct status, interact directly with the staff in the location to better support our undergraduate online students. Our face-to-face exposure at both our Atlanta and our Houston campus tends to drive a deeper level of engagement with our students, and we will continue to focus on how to keep our students more engaged at the online level, but what we're here today to talk about is really the approval of those academic activities at the site, so that one of the things that we've really seen benefit from is having the faculty member engaging with the staff that's also responsible for supporting the student through graduation. And currently, as we know, we're not allowed to have faculty at the site.
Okay, very good. Ms. Leonard, I do not have any other questions.
Anyone else have any questions?
Thank you. Was your May site visit was the mid-cycle review, I'm assuming?
I'm sorry?
Was the May site visit the mid-cycle review for HLC?
Yes.
Four-year? My question wasn't, because he commented on the health of the finances, but on your statement of affiliation, your institutional profile on HLC, it still has a letter on there regarding monitoring for finances back from 2014. Are you aware of that?
I'm not sure that the new report has been updated yet, subject to the approval here this week or next week that's coming, but our new HLC financial disclosure is much different than the one that might still be there.
Okay, and they generally, my only point for telling you is when they take you off of monitoring, if they took you off of monitoring prior, you can probably request that not be there if that's the case.
Right, thank you.
Still there.
So, in the application, you noted that in 2017, you have an enrollment of 12,588 students, and withdrawals you list 15,457. Explain that.
Dr. Mittman, what subsequent to the filing of the original application, Ms. Stanfill asked for some follow-up information on it, and because she wasn't able to tie out the numbers, so there was a subsequent PDF document that we provided retention rates. So there isn't a specific formula the board requires, so we did provide, and Terry, I don't know if that...
It should have been
in the folder. It's a one-page PDF that we provided the completion rates that are...
So the enrollment of 12,588 And then withdrawals of 15,457, that would leave like nationwide.
It's not an apples-to-apples comparison, which is what Ms. Stanfield pointed out, and so we did provide follow-up information to provide greater clarity in that area. The way the questions are asked, they aren't linked necessarily, and I learned that that is linked behind the scenes, and so we did provide a follow-up response to her.
Okay. And cash monitoring going back to 2011, is there a letter of credit posted also?
No. You were not required to post an LOC.
And then I assume that you're already approved through AZ Sarah?
Yes. NC Sarah.
Okay,
right.
So
yeah.
NC Sarah. So then, did you have to go through AZ Sarah? After that,
this time we're.
You have a physical presence, you would lose. You have to file with us instead.
Okay.
And at this point, we're in our conversations with Stanfield, it's focused simply on our Arizona residents. So Illinois is still, we're still with the Illinois as our portal state. At this point, that is something, if we choose to shift that, we would shift to Arizona, Sarah, and make that application to them.
Okay. And then one other question. And your default rate? How is that?
Right, so the last published 2014 cohort default rate is 16.2. It did trend up slightly from the previous years. We're still slightly worse than the 16 in the most recent, but we still have some time to work on that as far as the defaults.
Okay. So what's the... Why is it important to have an Arizona campus, given that you have Georgia, you have Illinois, you're online, and you're anticipating a largely, online student population?
Right. So I think we were here about 18 months ago when we asked for authorization from a service center perspective. And the reason for that was up until that point, we could show data that showed that we didn't serve the students in the western part of the U.S. and the state of Arizona as effectively from Illinois and or Atlanta. And so we wanted to come here and really, I mean, as you all know, because of your experience here, there's so much experience from a student service and faculty standpoint here in Arizona. I've been a resident here since 1983, and so we thought if we actually came west, we'd have a better opportunity to serve students that were interested in our programs in the west. That being said, we've had some very good success in helping students in Arizona and other western time zones. However, we haven't fully deployed our learning model from a personnel standpoint because of not having faculty approved. And so when we did this initially in Georgia about 2 years ago, we were able to implement faculty into the graduation teams. We saw increase in student outcomes and increases in retention rates. We also did the same thing in Illinois at our Schaumburg location, same thing. So it's an opportunity to enhance the services of the students that are being served in this area. One point of information, we do net promoter scores with our students often, twice a year, and currently the Chandler location has the highest net promoter score. We hope that it will also become the one with the highest outcomes when we add the ability to teach.
And as Mr. Klein mentioned, there's also the desire to possibly offer a small number of ground classes for students, and we wouldn't be able to do that with the administrative center approval. So it's twofold. And we were aware of that coming in, that we could not include faculty in our graduate teams, and we were okay with that, but we recognized on a long-term basis, and that's this step, is to be able to add them to the teams and also have those classes.
And then lastly, following up on Mr. Lucci's original questions about either litigation and other regulatory issues, common to have the class action fees for freshman culinary. I understand it's a different thing. I'm assuming that
I wouldn't say it's
filed. They were filed in 2000. I guess there was a June date for a final disposition.
I would say it's not uncommon for litigation to draw on forever. I think we just think of that in normal life. This one, because of the size and scope of it, we obviously didn't agree with the findings that were being alleged, and so there was a significant amount of back and forth. Again, if you've worked with any kind of litigation, you know there's a lot of positioning in terms of motions and actions that are taken. The company did move forward and, as I said, did reach a settlement with the attorneys representing Mr. Surratt and others, and so we're now through the implementation stage of that. The class notices have gone out to students. They had their response deadline has just passed. There was June 8th, I believe, there was a meeting last month with the judge to kind of follow through and finalize that. So we are at the end stages of that in terms of closing that out. We expect, I believe, that I'm not the lawyer in the group, but I believe that we will be complete with this yet this fiscal year because of where we're at with the settlement.
This one. So your vice president of financial, Nicole Stoll, I was just looking at her resume. Her degrees in history, and then in 2009, it says VP of Financial Aid Operations. I'm assuming she worked her way up that role, and when she took that role.
Right. And Craig, I would just say very similar to some of the experiences that we lived together. Nicole graduated from college. It was the first job into a financial aid role, and she worked her way up over time. Yes.
You might want to embellish that a little bit. Okay. It's kind of confused.
She didn't jump straight to a VP job.
But sadly, we have seen that. And there is no degree in financial aid or even a necessarily a particular background for it. But it's making sure that the resume is clearly showing her knowledge of financial aid and the path that she took to build up the experience, starting out as working your way up to various levels of management to MVP. Make it seem a little stronger, which leads it to my question that I had for you is your, and this happens a lot with schools in the route for a long time, they tend to not always go back and visit their catalog and make sure that it is worded maybe clearly a bit, could have, should have, would have, and when you came before us to get the license for just having this center here, it didn't fall under our jurisdiction to complain about your consumerism, but now it does. So particularly in your R224 policy, which the return to Title IV is a ridiculously complicated policy to begin with, and yours is written so vaguely, honestly, I, who am an expert on R224, couldn't really follow it. So it's on pages 63 and 66, and I will send my comments to Ms. Stanfield and she'll forward them to you. You just had some very vague language, vague to the point of being inaccurate one place and vague to the point of being confusing in two other places. So we'll just send it to you and have her look at it and reference the Federal Student Financial Aid Handbook and maybe even look at how some other schools have written it and shore up the language so it's more understandable.
Thank you. We appreciate the feedback. We, it's a very technical process and so we appreciate sometimes, another set of eyes is always helpful. So we welcome that.
Great, thank you. Any other questions? Mr. Lukey, are you interested in making a motion?
Oh, you have no idea. I am so interested. I would very much like to make a motion that we approve AIU for a regular degree granting license. Stipulate that they post a surety bond of $283,974. And that they also provide Ms. Stanfield's office electronic copies of the student records quarterly.
Yeah. Can I just have a question? What's the scope of the student record provision? Is it a roster or?
Transcript of the
for the Arizona students?
Arizona.
All Arizona students or just the campus? They're all now.
All right, so we have a motion. Do we have a second?
Clarification is you were at the time before.
No, I just think we're going to get complaints. I'd rather not. All right, we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Roll call vote. We'll start with you, Mr. Lupke.
Dick Lupke, aye.
Greg Jacob, aye.
Trish Leonard, aye.
Paul Mittman, nay.
Dr. Jennifer Leck, aye.
Bill Ventwell, aye.
All right. So the majority has voted to approve, so license is granted. Well, after you agree to stipulation.
Yes.
Yes.
And motion is granted. Good luck, and also don't come before the complaint committee if you can possibly.
All right. Thank you very much.
The next item on the agenda is the regular degree granting license application for Southeastern University. I believe those folks are on the phone. So if you.
We are.
Great. If you would say your name for the record, please.
I am Lisa Murphy, and I am the compliance director for the School of Unrestricted Education, which is essentially distance education.
Okay. Is anyone else on the phone with you?
That's it.
Okay. So Andrew Miller, the associate provost, was going to be, but he decided to leave you on your own?
He has high hopes for me.
All right. Ms. Stanfield?
Southeastern University degree grading license for Arizona. Partnering with the Green Center Church in Phoenix. I will clarify for you that the Nelson Green Center is not part of the Green Center Foundation. The school that licensed that was the new owner, I guess it was the
Green City.
No,
it's
Green Center.
Green Center.
The chancellor of Southeastern is...
He's on there, yeah. The board, but okay. It's not, there is not a relationship between Green Center and Southeastern. Just that. Your board member lead is Dr. Hall.
Jill, would you like to make an opening statement?
Lisa,
that too.
Me, I'm sorry. We're just very excited to be here and have the opportunity to get established in Arizona. We think we have some pretty unique programming and a way about making that possible to the residents of Arizona through our partnerships with these churches and how we make it possible for residents to attain an affordable undergraduate, and we do have some graduate programs, but right now we're focusing on undergraduate. We are a long-standing SACS-approved institution. We are very much mission-driven in that we infuse all of our courses with some religious education so that there is a worldview that is responsible. We've grown tremendously lately since we've established our distance education program in 2015. We're now in 21 states and have over 2,400 students enrolled in those programs. So we've just been really excited about the successes there, and we just want to participate in your state.
Thank you. So I have a list of questions for you. The first question I have is, all of the resumes that were submitted with the application are people who reside in Florida, which I assume are not moving to Arizona. Who is going to be running this facility?
We have a site director that's assigned there who will be basically an administrative person for us. So they will help with the enrollment process and help the students access the support services there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so I noticed the faculty, so a couple things. The faculty, all of those submitted, none of them look like they're in Arizona since this is a face-to-face. Who do you plan on hiring for faculty to teach these students?
Well, we are laying some groundwork is our approach here. I think you might have noticed that our first year's anticipated enrollment's only going to be about 10 students, and so that will not make it possible or affordable for us to do a face-to-face class. So initially, our students will be enrolled in online classes.
Got it.
And as we progress through the years and advertising, recruitment, that type of thing, and the word gets out about what we're doing, we will move to face-to-face. And we still, under a SACS authorization, accreditation, there are standards that we must uphold about being there and what their preparation is and ability to teach individual classes. So we will be required to meet that standard.
Okay, it was the map of the classrooms that kind of threw me off.
Yeah, we are setting ourselves up for success there. It's a really unique plan to get these partnerships going.
One thing I know that's a struggle is you might want to try and have your faculty update their resumes or vitas. One of those said that they anticipated graduating from their doctorate in 2007. I'm assuming that probably already happened.
I think it probably did, but we'll double check that and get them on. I think that's a problem most people have is keeping current with those things.
Oh, it absolutely
is. It is quite aged.
Just noticed that. Okay. Okay. So there's a couple things. Does SACS actually? Do you submit all your programs to SACS and SACS approves each program?
They do.
They do approve each and every program.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, interesting. Okay, that's different. In the enrollment agreement, there's the first bullet in there refers to your education as training programs. I thought that was an interesting choice of words versus like an academic program, because it's not really, I don't think that's considered training when you're ending with a degree.
You're right.
You might want to look at that.
Yeah.
On page 10, and I'm not quite sure. There's a lot of pieces of documents, but when you're talking, it's about initial high school transcripts. I think there could be a mistake in there where it references that all GPAs must be weighted in order to be accepted versus unweighted. And generally, we accept off, as a registrar, we accept off of unweighted, since not all schools have the option to provide weighted opportunities for students. So I'm not sure. You might want to double check that.
Okay, I'll double check that. I'm not versed on that particular issue. Okay.
Okay. Some of the other questions I had to do with the time that it takes to complete the degrees that were in the program forms and in the information about the two associates and the bachelors. So, for example, your associate of ministerial leadership said it took 2 years to complete or 64 weeks. And then the associates was the same way. And then the length of time listed for the bachelor's degree says 4 years, which is 208 weeks versus 128. So I thought you might want to just double check that.
I think there's a math error in there. Yeah, our degree programs generally are running, and I think better than most institutions, we run a little bit closer to time than a program, an associate program, somebody's taking a year and a half extra to complete. We're pretty close to time.
Okay. It also happened with a couple things. I looked at the bachelor's degree on your website, and the bachelor's degree in ministerial leadership said that it was 121 credits on the website, and in the program forms that you submitted, it said 122 credits. Even more, when you dug into what was listed, I couldn't get the math to tie out.
Okay. All right.
Your ministerial practicum was listed as 0 credits, which we think was the mistake. I'm not sure if there's electives in here, but the math just didn't work for any of the.
I see. Okay.
Any of them was listed, so.
Uh-huh. I do know that we went from 120 hours in the bachelor's program to 121, so that's probably a typo.
Okay. Okay, so now I'm really confused. In the documentation, and I guess one of the reasons I thought it was a face-to-face was there was also a site fee associated to the student of $3,000. Am I losing my mind?
No,
you're absolutely right. And again, we're just setting ourselves up for when we actually do the face-to-face.
Oh, so later, if you got approval for Facebook,
mm-hmm.
Once we
start registering them there and they start taking classes on site, then there is a site fee because that covers the site's overhead. And that's essentially what that is.
Of $3,000 per student?
Right. That's per year. And that has to do with any types of materials that they have to have. It has to do with the rooms and the overhead, all of that type of thing. It also covers the cost of their practicum experience.
Essentially, 33% of the cost associated with the student's education would be associated with the site fee. I guess I should reference the program for the $6,600
Right? I'm not reading. That's probably.
So it's per credit and plus the additional
$3,000? Yes.
The tuition is only $6,600. That site
That's
fee
correct.
Alone was $3,000. I was.
The site fees are determined mainly by the amount of effort that the site has to put into administering the program, and it covers basically because when the student does their practicum experience, they're there on campus.
Right, this is almost equates to room and board. We should just sleep there. I guess I just worry that when you get to that point that you think about how that's going to be split up, determined, refund, what's the refund possibility on that, that be well thought out, because I can see that's such a large amount. I can see that was my first concern of students
okay.
getting really upset about what they have to withdraw and where that $3,000 goes.
I will look further into that and break it down to where it is better described for your understanding. I'll have to explain to you that I'm fairly new to Southeastern, and I'm not in the point where I am privy to all of the negotiations with the sites, so I've got to get more background on that for myself as well.
I think the only other comment I had was when I went on your website, I actually, two things, I tried to use their search function and I couldn't actually get it to search or give me a box to type in to search. I couldn't locate the two associates programs that you are offering here are not, unless I'm mistaken, I was unable to locate those two associates degrees. When you click on undergraduate ministerial leadership, you click on it, the only thing that comes up is the bachelor's degree, so I wasn't able to find those, and I was unable to search for the word associate to try and see if I could find it a different way.
Oh, okay.
Are you able to do it?
I can't find the catalog, though.
How did you search? I couldn't get it to search.
Under, there's a picture of the guy at the microphone that says ministry degree programs, and then has associates of ministerial leadership. I just clicked on it.
Picture with a guide with a microphone.
Yeah. There's several places to look on the website, and the first one being that search magnifying glass up there, and then it returns information that's much like a Google search, but then also with regard to the programs, at the bottom of the page, there you can get to the catalog, the student catalog, and that's really where we try to move people towards that catalog so that they get the best, most current information.
On the main page here. So
I can... at the very bottom, under academics, there's that black box. Under academics, there's the catalog.
Okay, so it's another page. When you just do a Google search for your school, it brings up a different main page, which didn't have the search thing and didn't have the catalog, but then this one does have it, so I guess it just depends on how you get there.
And I was in IE, so Explorer wouldn't come up at all. You couldn't even get the bar, but when I went into Chrome, now I can, so
oh,
you might want to know. I spent all my time
Well, no, that's it. Yes, no, I want to say that to the IT people. Explorer. Search doesn't work. Okay.
All right, so I don't know.
Yeah, we definitely want to be able to be found.
Okay. That's the end of my questions.
Can I ask a follow-up just based on what Dr. Leck just queried about the site fee?
Okay.
So in other words, to have an on-ground student at some point in the future, the student's going to pay a site fee. And you sort of intimated, or I think you intimated, that the site fee is something that will be paid, that the university is going to pay to the site. So, for example, the church that's housing the program here in Arizona. Is that how it will work? So, in other words,
there is a financial relationship between the school and the church, which is the site, and we do have to remunerate for their expenses to the degree and what all is included in there for what specific thing. I really should not speak to because I don't know the scope of it.
I'm just sort of thinking out loud as I'm trying to piece this together, in that if there's an on-ground student, there will be more revenue paid to the church as opposed to an online student, whereas the student's not paying that fee, so that's not going to the site. In which case, as far as like the partner here in Arizona, they wouldn't get any of those additional revenues as online students. I guess I'm just trying to clarify the financial relationship.
And I would like to speak to it further, but that is something, just like you, I need to know a little bit more about. I've only heard discussions, in different meetings, and I lack the understanding to help clarify at this time. But I will be more than happy to provide that by tomorrow for you.
You know what? That's sort of an unusual thing you have going there, and none of us quite know what to do with it. Including, Title IV aid, how would it be in the cost of tenants? Is it allowable expenses? So we would feel more comfortable if you could come back in August with somebody who is more intimate with that.
Certainly.
So that we just feel more comfortable because we're all a little bit flummoxed about that. All right.
I'm happy to do that. Yes.
So would you mind doing that? Is there anything else? Anyone want to bring in the comments for now? We'll just wait the whole thing.
Probably want to clarify exactly what you were going to do.
Yeah.
Is that instead of?
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe all the notes you've sent to the sample that she can put on to the school.
Sure.
No, could you type them?
Sure. Okay, then I'm making a motion to postpone the approval of the regular degree granting license for Southeastern University until the
clarification
regarding fee structure is brought back to the board members. In when? In October?
For August.
August.
23rd, I think it is.
August 23rd.
They said it'll be August 23rd. So I would suggest that you speak with Mr. Miller and discuss the tuition and site fee charges and how it might be more appropriately determined, especially in terms of how it would be treated with on Title IV and refund policies and so on and so forth.
All right, so we have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
Okay, a motion, second. Further discussion? All right. All those in favor of postponing?
Frank Jacob, aye.
Trish Leonard, aye.
Paul Mittman, aye.
Dr. Jennifer Luck, aye.
Bill Ventwell, aye.
Nick Lutke, aye.
All right, so we will, I won't say we'll see you in August, we'll hear you in August.
We hope to see you. Thank you all for your time. I appreciate it.
Bye. All right. That was just getting too complicated.
Okay. That was something I'd never seen before in my life.
And if any of you have notes on that school that you want to forward to Ms. Stanfield, she can get them to them, and then they can respond, be prepared to respond. All right. The next item on the agenda is the Conditional Vocational Program License Application of MedStar Academy. You come forward, and Ms. Stanfield, if you could give us a recap.
Robin Enterprises LLC, the MedStar Academy, is seeking a military vocational program license to offer two programs in phlebotomy and pharmacy tech. Just a little bit into FEMA's asking, what is from Western Career Institute? He was licensed by the board, like Steven started, but I don't know about that.
Steve Ashmary.
He failed to tell Ms. Buckey that the license renewal was due. So when we determined that it would be much more cost-benefit that she just close out Western Career and she would apply.
Some L name.
I really butchered that.
All right, so if you introduce yourself, give us a brief recap.
I'm Robin Gote, and I am now the owner of MedStar Academy, Robin Enterprises LLC. As Terry stated, it's been a process. She politely told me that I inherited a mess. So we started over, and here we are, ready to begin our new school.
Wonderful. So there were catalog and enrollment agreement such that you went through and revamped them and made them your
yes.
own?
Yes.
You did a very good job. I understand you've had some talented people helping you.
Maybe. Yes, I did. Thank goodness.
Well, very good job.
Thank you.
So I do have a few questions, but it actually was in very good order. So you can thank all those who helped you get there. They did a good job, and as did you. On the cost, I thought it was interesting that the cost of the two programs was so close, but the number of hours offered was quite different. Is there a reason why one is more expensive to?
Yes. The phlebotomy program has a lot of supplies, lots of needles and vacutainers and lots more supplies, and I think that's what the difference is.
Okay. And externships. We get a lot of complaints from students about externships. And so when I looked at your agreements, the documents showed there was one for each, but when I opened them up, they both were for farm tech. Neither was for phlebotomy. It said phlebotomy, but I opened it up, it expressly had the farm tech program written in.
Previously, there was a contract with Honor Health for the phlebotomy program, and I'm currently negotiating with a couple different people for externship sites. It's very difficult. They only take one or two students at a time, so if you have a class of 20, students have to wait. That's one thing that's not very favorable for the phlebotomy program. I spoke with Banner just yesterday, and I'm getting different ideas from different people on who to go with. Downstairs is Partners in Recovery, and they've offered to help out our phlebotomy students, but they don't really have a lab, so it would just be for their sticks, number of sticks that they are required to do. Also, I've spoken with Lab Express, as we do a lot of business with them for our drug panels. So those are currently being negotiated.
Well, so here's the deal. You need to not start more students than you can place in externship.
Right.
So students can't get to the end and then have to have this big sit out.
No.
While you're waiting to find externship.
Right. So, no, I won't start the program until I have that in place.
And then on an ongoing basis, because the externship sites can say yay or nay of whether they're going to continue to have people coming in. So it's something you always have to keep a handle on, of how many externship sites you have and how many they can take.
Yes.
And how many students you have. And your for our pharmacy, it looks like you had two, and one of them is with Walgreens, which is obviously large. But same thing, maybe that's an agreement with Walgreens Corporation, but do you have a relationship that the sites are going to accept your students?
Yes. Walgreens is very good. They have different locations all over the valley, so they're always able to take all of our students.
Okay. So just keep an eye on that, and if we get complaints that the students are saying that they were told it would be an externship that was convenient to their home, and it turns out they have to take three buses and a cab to get there, that's not going to be acceptable.
Yes, I understand that.
On one of the documents that you had, that had your refund policy listed, the last box, the greater than 50%, it said you can retain 100%, but the actual box didn't have any verbiage on it. So there were three documents you gave to the board with the chart, and one of them, it was missing. So just make sure that all your materials clearly have that.
Is it broken up onto the second page, maybe, or?
I don't have the prints in front of me. You don't have all that many documents here, but the refund there was three times, and two were good and one was not.
Okay.
And that was actually all I had. Yeah, that was some sort of record.
I think so.
Anyone else have questions?
I have a question. You have a note payable to the bank.
Yes.
For $240,000.
$214,000.
Okay. And is that all due this year?
No. That's over 20 years, actually.
Good.
Yeah.
So and the way you compiled your financial statements, you counted that as a current liability, so it gives you this horrible current ratio of 0.03. But really, the only portion that you needed to include in that calculation is what you pay in the next 12 months.
Okay.
So theoretically, a 20th of, if it's all evenly distributed, of the $200,000.
Okay.
So say for argument's sake, it's $10,000 a year. So your current liability, the current portion, $10,000, not given whatever $1,000. So it'll look better next time you file your report with this with the secondary, but also if you're going out for other financing or for other purposes.
Okay. You want that? You want me to make a correction for that?
No, I mean just probably off the.
Good to know.
Off the top of my head.
Yeah.
You probably have a good current ratio, but it looks bad.
Okay.
It's probably good. So it's like, it's better than coming here the other
way. Okay.
It's better than coming here the other way where it's the calculation is better, but it turns out you're better. And it turns out that you're better positioned to be the change that you wish to see in the world.
Thank you for that.
Right.
So happy.
Thank you for that positive thing.
Okay.
That was in her.
Yes, it was. I saw that. Anyone else have any questions? All right, now this is seriously a testimony to how well the end product ended up being. So whatever pain you went through to get there, and those who helped you may have gone through to get there, this is good. And obviously, we always view the application to judge how administratively capable you are. So we trust that you will be as good as your packet was.
I promise.
Except for the finance part. all right, then. I don't know if you appropriate requirement here. Hang on. You have to say it a certain way. I just have to make sure I get it right. All right. You are aware that they there's a stipulation for a $15,000 surety bond?
Yes, I have that.
So I make a motion to approve the conditional vocational program license application with the stipulation that the $15,000 surety bond be maintained. Do we have a second?
Second.
We have a motion and second. You agree to that stipulation?
Yes.
All right. Any further discussion? All right. Roll call vote.
Craig Jacob, aye.
Chris Leonard, aye.
Paul Mittman, aye.
Dr. Jennifer Leck, aye.
Bill Ventual, aye.
Dick Lipke, aye.
All right. Congratulations.
Thank you.
All right. And the last but not least, Unitech EMT LLC. Huh?
Yeah, don't need it.
I think the last time I didn't bring
right. By one. There you go. So,
right. We'll be done by one.
If first, Ms. Stanfield, if you will give us a brief recap.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Boyd, you with that PNT, you're seeking a non-accredited vocational program license to offer the vocational program. UNITEC is also licensed to offer the EMT program in California, as well as they have several other programs, all under the main parent of college education. We did let you know yesterday that they received the final approval for UNITEC.
Really? That's why he flew in early.
And when I was working with Steve, I had let him know that the surety bond calculation came to 38.5, that they then come and go ahead and hopefully come out with.
Okay, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Say your name for the record.
My name is Christopher Seymour. I am the program director for Unitech EMT.
And I'm Steve Watkins. I'm vice president of regulatory affairs for the parent company of Unitech EMT.
Any opening statement?
Yes, I'd just like to say good afternoon and thank you all for this opportunity to be here to provide our application today. And we're looking forward to providing this service to the community, where it will not only provide a paramount service, but also bolster the career paths of our future students. I'd also like to apologize that our medical director, Dr. Walter Simmons, couldn't be here himself today. Yeah, he is responding to a staffing issue at a local emergency department.
Okay. Could you explain a little bit about the history of you started in California. What made you come down to Phoenix in the first place? You said you moved some of your operations down here, and then how did this evolve?
Sure. So the EMT program in California has been running since 2006, I think, so a long time. And in California, we run it as we call it a boot camp model, and so students fly in. It's not only local students, and they take a 2 weeks vacation, they come on site, they stay in a hotel, they're on site 12 hours a day, and they plow through the program. And that was working very well in California. We got renewed every year until costs in California started to go up quite significantly. Our relationship with the local housing providers for our students, like the hotels who could provide shuttle services and house students, started to be fewer and fewer and more expensive and more expensive. And so we've been in the lookout for a possible balancing act to the expensive program in California, or a possible place to go to then move the program. And coincidentally, unrelated to the decisions of the EMT program, another division of our company that does corporate IT training moved to Chandler, Arizona. And they had such a fantastic experience, I guess. Their feedback was, we can hire people, they can afford houses. I mean, it's amazing. So that kind of became a default. Well, maybe that's where we should put the EMT program, or at least try it there. We already have a building. We already have some corporate staff from various departments there. We have admissions reps sitting in Chandler who are selling the California program right now. So when Chris, I guess, investigated how would that look to do an EMT program in Arizona, there was a lot of things that kind of converged where the EMT regulations themselves allow for a even more condensed version of the program without a lot of the extra hours and topics that California requires. So it seemed to be an easy, all signs were pointing to try out this Chandler, Arizona thing. And so that's how we came to be here.
Okay. So it's the same concept, 14 days, 12 mm-hmm. hours a day, immersive. They get meals, that's nice.
They do, yeah.
So your catalog looks good. The section that is confusing to me is payment schedule, payment methods.
You told me.
One paragraph says Unitech does not have any predetermined institutional payment plans.
Yes.
And then the next paragraph says, if you wish to set up a payment plan, you can discuss it with the business manager. So what are you trying to say here? I mean, you don't take federal funds.
We're going to relitigate our discussion.
Yeah, you don't take federal funds.
No.
Do you provide funding for these students, or do they have to go to a third party to get it?
We do not provide funding.
Okay.
So it's typically in California, it's been students are paying cash or
right.
out of their pocket, or they do a Sallie Mae loan or something like that. But we don't facilitate anything like a loan process or a payment process for them.
And so they have to have monies paid by day one.
All money paid by day one.
Okay. Yeah. And if a student obtains a loan to pay for an additional education program, the student will have to pay the full amount of the loan plus interest. So it's confusing. That sounds like you're going to loan them money. I would reword that.
I can see what you mean. That language you just read is actually left over from our California catalog, where they require that language. And they basically say you have to fully disclose to a student that if they're paying you cash, but they have some other loan somewhere, that may affect how you collect your refund, or if they, who gets paid first, if it goes to court, that kind of thing.
Okay.
But
that's something about that. If you have borrowed money, mm-hmm. you must meet the terms of that loan arrangement with that.
With whoever.
Yes, just make it clear so it's not.
Make it clear it's not us.
Somehow partnering with that.
But you say right after, we don't. You know, Unitech does not participate in federal loan programs and doesn't offer loans. So it's very. About the payment plan.
Well,
reword that. You'll definitely help you.
That makes sense. Also, I was fully interpreting payment plan kind of as a separate from a loan, meaning I could envision someone saying, I want a payment plan where I'll pay the full tuition by day one, but I want to do it at $200 a week for the next X number of weeks.
I hear what you're saying, right? But you titled that paragraph as payment methods, so it was that kind of could be a payment. Someone can consider that being paying the plan.
I see.
How to pay for this.
The payment plan is usually you don't have to pay it all by the first day, and it's you're making payments throughout the enrollment and after you pay before you graduate or whatever it's going to be. That's normally what the payment plan is.
Makes
sense. You're still talking about layaway. You can pay and get it later. Payment plan is usually you already got it and you're paying.
Would it make more sense to simply say, we do not offer any payment plans, period?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Pay everything before day one. Okay. That's what it said. Okay, I understand.
And the only other questions I have is about the certification.
Yes.
That they have to take. Is that included in their tuition? Do they have to pay for that separately?
We do offer a voucher that allows them to take their National Registry of EMT cognitive examination for free for us.
Did I miss that in here, that you offer the voucher?
It's bundled in the tuition, and the word...
You should put that in here. You should write that out, that you offer that, that's part of their tuition.
I think that's spelled out directly in the enrollment agreement, maybe not in the catalog.
Okay.
But I can just make sure it's copied.
It shouldn't be anything. The enrollment agreement is sort of a subset of what's in the catalog, but everything should be in the catalog.
Got it.
And sometimes people get confused about if you're saying that they take in licensing fee that you're giving the voucher, mm-hmm. and so student drops out halfway, and they say, "I'm not taking that test, so I want you to refund that portion." So just be cautious of how you word it, that people aren't saying, "Well, I know that is $200. Mm-hmm. I quit before that, so I want that $200 back."
Right.
So just watch your words.
Yeah, I understand.
And I do have one. And is there a certain time frame that they have to take the certification?
Yeah, we recommend that they take the National Registry examination within 30 days of graduating the program, so that way their knowledge is still fresh.
So if someone doesn't do it and they come back like a year later saying, "I'm ready to take it, can I get my voucher?" You're going to honor that?
I believe so.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think there's NREMT themselves doesn't have a, do they have a timeline?
No, they don't.
So there's no regulatory body holding us to a maximum timeline. So in theory, if they leave us and they don't take the test and they come back a year later and say, "I'm now using my voucher, they paid for it, so sure, we will honor it." But okay. We do offer a free retake of the course if they don't pass the NREMT.
You're not held any certification requirements of so many people have to pass your test before anything?
No, the NREMT, well, you know more than me. The NREMT who gives the certification exam simply requires that you graduate from or complete a program of an approved EMT school. That's their entire requirement. Then you take their test. I'm not aware of another requirement.
No,
right?
That's correct.
But they do log pass rates of their exam, and those are things that various state agencies may or may not hold us to independently.
The background check?
Mm-hmm.
The background check. Do you try to get these done before the student enrolls? This paragraph really talks about it could take up to a year to investigate this. And so what happens to a student that, you know, in that situation? They're going to have to stop and wait until it's fully vetted out?
Yeah, that's a difference from our California. In California, we have not had a need for an admissions requirement of a background check, but it was a good idea in Arizona to do it. So that policy is kind of mirrored from, we have a sister school that does nursing programs that, of course, require background checks. And we have that disclaimer in there because there are those situations where something is on the background check that we think might prevent you from getting the license. It's a gray area. It requires the state or somebody to do a final sign-off. And we're telling people that could take a year. And no, we wouldn't enroll them until they clear it. So it's not meaning it's a common occurrence.
I said something about you could have something or the background check.
Not or. It's a back. They want to do a background check as part of the admissions process. And they pay for it. The first one. The subsequent one, the student will have to pay for it if there's an issue. Exactly.
I assume so, but we should spell that out. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just trying to sort it. It is good that you're waiting to enroll them if there's something sketchy. Just we have had situations with schools where the students divulge they had some prior criminal issue in the past. They enrolled them anyway, and then the person could not get a job because nobody would hire a person in that field with that.
And sometimes it precludes them from getting a National Registry certification anyway, so what we're really trying to do is stop that situation from happening before it starts.
That's all I have.
You
got
any questions? The same question we had with another school, you have discontinuation. In the event that Unitech EMT discontinues the program, a full refund of all monies will be paid the students who have enrolled and not started. So it's only a 14-day, right?
Right.
So day five, you just aren't feeling it, so you just decide to just stop that class. They would still be charged a probationary.
I see what you're asking. The discontinuation sentence in the catalog is also mirrored from California. The intention of that is if we discontinue the program and you've already enrolled, but it hasn't started.
Well, that's
yet,
a good
right?
statement. I'm yeah. just asking what happens if in the middle of it
we decide we're shutting down or we're stopping the program for some reason.
Wasn't a happy place to
use. That'd be a full
faculty
refund.
Faculty is sick and you can't find a replacement.
Gotcha. Right. That would be a full refund unless the student actually says, "No, I want to reschedule. Keep my deposit. I'll sign another EA." But by default, that would be full refund, and we can easily add that to that sentence. Yeah. We wouldn't keep the reg fee or anything.
Yeah, that would be lovely if you just have an explanation for any reason that...
If it's our fault, yeah.
And you could have something in about that, you know, and like I said, the instructor could get sick, like especially when you're just wrapping up, you have one instructor that gets sick. Mm-hmm. It could be you have something that says that it would be rescheduled in a reasonable period of time, but the person would be offered a refund so that you're not have to automatically give back 100% if you're able to resume in a week or something. Just because it's such an intense short time, literally something could happen that the course gets interrupted. And it would be easy to have an explanation.
Yeah.
What happened.
That makes sense. Yeah. Under discontinuation.
Anyone else have anything?
Okay. I will make a motion to approve the conditional vocational program license application for Unitech EMT with the stipulation that the $38,175 surety bond be maintained with the and the corrections we've recommended on your catalog.
In the catalog, yeah.
Be done.
All right, motion and second.
Second.
All right, and motion and second. Do you agree to the stipulations?
Yes, we do.
All right. Any further discussion? All those in favor by roll call?
Aye. Craig Jacob, aye.
Chris Leonard, aye.
Paul Mittman, aye.
Dr. Jennifer Leck, aye.
Bill Vance Wolf, aye.
Dick Lipke, aye.
All right, congratulations. Enjoy Chandler, and we don't want to see you in front of the promotion committee. So.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
I'm just going to say that from now on, because obviously that sponsor worked. All right, thank you, gentlemen.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So, call to the public. Okay. Board business, Ms. Stanfield.
We're in the process of completing the October review right now. The majority of the schools have uploaded their documents. We've got some problems, we've got some issues. They resolve some in about 20 minutes as soon as we finish here to go and figure out a couple of things. UBI is she's great. She's been very helpful with telling me what we're doing wrong and
she's
fixing the problems as we go.
Doing that with me as well.
So we should be good. But this is the first time that we've used the portal all the way through. So that schools can do it on their last renewal cycle Salesforce on the office. Yeah. So a couple little challenges here and there, but I think we are going to extend. So the deadline for applications is August 1st. Late fees would start August 2nd. Because we've had some challenges, we want to extend that date to August 6th for the renewal to be completed. And then the
and are you going to, I did get feedback from a school that says that they had gotten a message that because there were issues, it was postponed, no date was given, and then the next message they got was it's still due August 1st, and they were a little thrown off by that.
Yeah, I communicated with everybody, and if you let me know who it is later, and I'll make sure that they get what I'd really like to do, is, because the majority of the people are following along and will make the August 1st deadline. Some weren't. Those that typically started a little bit later, a little more time. So we're going to do that on a case-by-case basis.
This person's going to make it. She just said that she had thought she had more time, but just because all her own things going on, she still wanted to get it done by August 1st.
Yeah, my fear was to send out a blanket August 6th, and then everybody's waiting until August 5th to tell me that they couldn't upload it. So I would rather keep it where we're at and still grant them that little leeway at the end.
So you've heard from everyone that they are all working on it?
Yeah, I can tell.
Oh, yeah, we're working on it. Yeah.
And they all know that their aim is to get it done by August 1st.
I forgot to cross this T. You forgot to dot this I. I'm so sorry. I'm back to you guys.
So, yeah, so we have done the right path.
Wonderful.
It's always every Friday.
I heard that you're very patient in doing the training. So.
It would be helpful if people would just read the instructions. That would solve a lot of the problems.
In life in general.
Yes.
I think people don't read anymore. What are we talking about?
Before I forget, I will let you guys know I'm out of town. I'll be on the next week. I will check an email, but you can contact me.
Stake sale.
I think I have some of them in the shed somewhere.
Yeah.
All right, anything else? All right, our goal is to be done before 1 o'clock, so I'm so pleased that it's 12:45, so we are...